80% of Americans say they believe in heaven, but they offer no consistent version of just what heaven might be. Yes, most religions place it above the sky, but that's where the agreement ends. In her new book, Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife, Lisa Miller follows the conceptions of heaven throughout history, tracing how the religious visions of heaven have adapted to the changing needs of the faithful. Her book is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased that it brings Lisa Miller to our show today. Hello.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
You trace conceptions of heaven among Jews, Christians, and Muslims, but you write that the English word heaven is actually quite problematic.
Right.
Why?
It's a mush. You know, in the Hebrew Bible, there's a word for sky. There's a word for the world to come, which is what happens after the world ends. There's a word for Eden. There's a word for paradise. But there's not a word that mushes all of these concepts together. And in America, when we talk about heaven, we talk about all of these things. When we say somebody's going to heaven or grandma's in heaven, we mean all of these things plus everything else we think about heaven, you know, New Yorker cartoons, images from songs and greeting cards, things that we were taught in childhood, feelings that we've had of transcendent love or overwhelming power. And so nothing in the Bible gives us that meaning.
Well, how important is heaven to the Jewish concept? It seems to me heaven is much more on the minds of Christians and Muslims.
It's true that Christians and Muslims took the idea of heaven and embroidered it and developed it more fully, and definitely in Christianity, you know, it's much more central to the theology. But many Jews are surprised to learn that the Jews invented the idea of heaven, that is, a place in the sky where you go to live with God forever and ever, correlated with your faithful behavior on earth. That is an idea that happened in Jerusalem about 200 years before Jesus.
And does hell automatically become part of this picture?
Jews don't have a clear conception of hell. What Jews have is a separation from God, which is hell enough in Jewish theology. In Christianity, the idea of, you know, falling down into a stinking pit, that became much more fully embroidered.
And was that borrowed from the Greeks and the Romans?
Well, actually, Zoroastrianism, which was a religion that the Jews encountered during the exile in Babylon, has this idea that there's an up and a down, that the good go up and that the bad fall off this bridge into a stinking pit. So it was carried on from the Jews, but it was the Christians who really took it over.
That's Zarathustra, and that everything is light and dark in that religion. And that religion, some people say, still colors the Muslim concepts of Shiism in Iran, because that was where Zoroastrianism thrived. There's still some Zoroastrians in the world today.
Not very many.
Farsi, I think.
Yeah, not very many, but a few, yeah.
So how influential were all of the other cultures around? For example, the Egyptian belief in the afterlife.
Right. One of the things I love best about the idea of heaven is that, you know, in this cataclysmic theological change, that souls, people rose to be with God after death and live there forever, were all of these influences. There were Egyptian influences. There were Zoroastrian influences. There were pagan influences. There was ancestor worship. But by far, the biggest influence was the Greek culture, and the idea that the soul ascended to be with God after having attained sufficient wisdom.
Well, the Greeks also put their gods on Mount Olympus. Is it always a place above?
Well, in Eastern religion, it's not, right? But in Western religion, almost universally, people think of God as living in the sky. And so when you go to be with God, you go up into the sky. Now, ancestors were thought to live underground, you know, beneath the earth, and you could call them up. That's where they lived. But heaven is, in Western religion, always in the sky.
What do you mean when you use the word heaven in this book?
Right. Well, so I approach this because I'm a rationalist. I'm a skeptic. My father is a scientist. I'm a journalist. I don't come to these ideas very easily and naturally. But what I found that I loved about heaven were two things. One is, you know, the kingdom of God among us. That is, when we love each other as best we can, when we do social justice, when we do art or even utopian farming communities, we are trying to emulate what God wants from us here on earth. That is like heaven. And the other idea is this sort of idea of a radical gift from God. One Orthodox scholar I talked to, an Orthodox Jewish scholar I talked to, called it, you know, a radical gift of grace and kindness on God's part. And I like the radical nature of heaven.
Lenny in Brooklyn left a comment on our show page. He said, I remember my grandma's rendition of heaven, which amounted to being in church singing hymns to God forever. I remember thinking that forever was an awful long time to spend sitting on hard wooden pews.
Right. Well, there are two things there. One is that what Christian musicologists would say is that if God is there, then it's not boring. Then you're connecting with God, and you're not thinking about the hard wooden pews. And the other part of that is that from at least the Essenes forward, religious people have thought of prayer in church, prayer in synagogue, singing, praise, as literally connecting them to the activities of the angels in heaven. So that when you are in church, you are doing what the angels do in heaven, and that's why you get this kind of overwhelming, transcendent feeling.
So we have this, let's break down the conceptions of heaven to in the different religions involved. Heaven is where God lives. Is it where we live forever and are rewarded for leading a perfect life in all three religions?
Yes, it is now. In the Torah, heaven is where God lives, but it is emphatically not where we live.
So when did that change? Does the Torah begin the whole? Well, first of all, the Torah is the book of monotheism. So I guess it's the first time anybody would have talked about a single God. But it would be God living rather than God being some kind of a spirit, being omnipresent, as I remember my Hebrew teacher teaching me.
Right. I mean, in the Torah, God lives up in the sky. And when he talks to people, he sends down angels or he talks to people from the sky. But one of the things about the Torah is that it emphatically does not say that people go to heaven to be with God. In fact, when Jacob lays his head down on a rock and he has a vision of the gate of heaven and the ladder going up to heaven, he doesn't think to himself, oh, gee, that looks like a nice place. I want to go there. He thinks, what a terrifying place. That must be the home of God. When the people tried to build a tower to reach heaven in the story of Babel, God knocks the tower down and disperses the people. So he is not saying, you know, come on, y'all, live with me in heaven. The idea that people would ascend to heaven and live with God happened around 167 BCE, around the time of the Maccabean revolt. And it was a gift that the rabbis, the teachers, gave to Jewish people for adhering to the monotheism that was so precious.
So the concepts of heaven change as the social and political winds change.
Definitely. It was an effect of individualism, the growing individualism of the Jewish people. You know, before the exile, before the first century, Jewish identity was communal. You know, you were part of a tribe. The best you could hope for was to sleep underground with your ancestors. And after that, you know, individual rewards became very important. That was part of the Greek influence.
My guest is Lisa Miller, award-winning journalist in the field of religion and the religion editor at Newsweek. She has written a book called Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife. It is published by Harper. When Christianity started seeing itself as a separate religion rather than a sect of Judaism, it started doing things to separate itself from the Jews, including changing the day of the Sabbath, the dietary laws, and the like. Did heaven also come into this?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that the Jews expect in heaven is to get their temple back, right? Because the temple was destroyed twice, and they expect that in the world to come they'll have their temple back. That's crucial to Jewish identity. In the Christian heaven, there is no temple. There's no need for a temple because Jesus is there. The whole idea of salvation is a Christian idea. I mean, it was the Christians who emphasized salvation and the things that you have to do to get to heaven or not.
And what about those images we have of heaven, the pearly gates, gold streets, a garden? Do they actually come out of something textual?
Yes. I mean, all of those images that we have in popular culture, as you say, the pearly gates.
St. Peter.
not St. Peter from this particular text, but the jeweled walls and the, you know, the pearl gates and the city in the middle of the walls and the garden and the flowing rivers. And all of that comes from the book of Revelation, which was written around the year 90. So after the fall of Jerusalem in 70, by somebody who was probably a convert to Christianity or had Jewish parents, somebody who knew the Jewish texts and knew the Jewish history of the idea of heaven and visions of heaven, but made it into a Christian text, because here is Jesus coming back, you know, and he comes back as a warrior, as a, you know, on a steed. He's magnificent. Jesus becomes part of this vision of heaven in a really emphatic way.
You're right that Christians often use urban imagery when they describe heaven. Why do you think that is?
Well, because it's about, I mean, because the idea that Jerusalem will come back, will be rebuilt after it was sacked by the Romans in 70, is a common theme in the history of heaven, both for Jews and for Christians.
Well, all three of the religions we're talking about largely were set in the desert or semi-desert areas. Is that why heaven is so rich and so lush with greenery?
Right. When I talk about the Muslim heaven, I often say, you know, people create heaven, ideas of heaven that are the opposite of what they have on earth, you know. And Islam was founded in the 7th century in probably the most awful place on earth. I mean, it was 120 degrees. There was no water anywhere. The Bedouin tribes were, you know, ruthless and killed each other all the time, fought off over these terrible small patches of land. Children often were killed because the families didn't have enough food to feed everybody. So Muslim heaven is this overflowing, verdant, wet, fountains, rivers. Food doesn't spoil. I think that's a detail that's really important in a place that's 120 degrees all the time. You rest on silk embroidered couches and you wear beautiful clothes and you say to each other, peace. You know, it seems like a great reward for these desert
dwellers. Well, how different than the Christian heaven? Just a richer version?
It's much more like the Garden of Eden and much less urban, just the visions given to us in Scripture.
Over time, as different religious groups change, we get different visions of heaven, don't we? The Puritans had a different one from the Methodists.
Well, definitely. I mean, one of the problems with the Puritan heaven was that it was this distant carrot, right? You were going to go to heaven if you were really good and faithful, but the Puritans were very emphatic about not embroidering heaven. So they didn't talk about who you were going to see there, what you were going to do there, how you were going to feel there. One historian of American religion said to me, you know, it's like you're trudging along and trudging along and trudging along, and you're aware of the distant rewards, but they're very remote. So around the time of the Civil War, heaven became peopled again in Protestant religion because it was too hard for all the people who lost people in the Civil War to imagine this austere, cold, distant reward.
And there were many new religions, Christian, Protestant groups that developed after the Civil War.
That's right. It was a very rich time in American religious history, and largely to give people a more personal, spiritual, accessible heaven.
Now, isn't heaven making a comeback? You reference a 1997 Time magazine cover story where the reporter wrote, "Heaven is AWOL. People still believe in it. It's just that their concept of exactly what it is has grown foggier, and they hear about it much less frequently than their pastors." Also, at that time, it was 72% of Americans believed in heaven. Now it's up to 81%.
Right. I mean, I argue in the book that belief in heaven is less necessary as things on earth get good. And 1997 was sort of the peak of American, you know, 20th century prosperity. And post 9/11, I think there's this perception, for me personally, but I think among a lot of the people I know, that things are kind of dire and the economy is terrible and there's war abroad and the population is aging. And so there's this feeling like we need heaven more than we did possibly 10 years ago.
It is interesting that all the cartoon images of heaven are people standing on clouds. But early in the 20th century, we started going above the clouds. Now we have gone outside of Earth's atmosphere. We've traveled to the moon. The Hubble telescope can take us to the deepest parts of our universe, and yet where do people think heaven is?
Right. I'm very literal-minded, and I had that very same question. You know, why do we think heaven is in the sky? How can you get there? In the Middle Ages, people actually thought it was a place that you could get to if you could just find the right mountain to travel behind. And so I visited a Christian astrophysicist at Harvard who is known for both being a believing Christian and also a very prominent astrophysicist. And I presented him with this problem, you know, okay, so where is heaven? Thought he might have some thoughts about that. And for him, the conundrum about heaven wasn't about where it is, because in his professional life, he studies places you can't see. And he understands that there are places you can't see where the laws that govern our physical world don't apply.
So this is all answered by quantum mechanics?
I don't know anything about quantum mechanics, so we didn't get into it. But I was interested in his he was very nonchalant about the problem of placeness and heaven. What he was uncomfortable with and what presented a problem for him was the problem of changelessness. He said, you know, we humans are defined by change. You know, we change every minute. We learn things. We forget things. We fall in love. We have children. We grow old. Our hair grows gray. Our hair falls out. You know, how does we strive for things. We want things. We get hungry. You know, how does a place that's characterized by changelessness accommodate this creature that's so defined by change? And that was the conundrum for him that he couldn't resolve.
Have concepts of hell changed in the same way that concepts of heaven have?
We Americans believe much less in hell than we used to. And part of the reason is that we've become much more universalist. We believe that, you know, most good people go to heaven. And even sort of conservative Christians, fundamentalist Christians who are taught that Jesus is the only way to heaven, concede that probably their neighbors who are Muslims or Jews will also go there. And so hell has very little room in a world like that.
Well, you've described this book as a history of heaven, but it seems as though it's really a history of the way people in the Western culture have thought about themselves.
Definitely. I don't think that we can know anything empirically about heaven, so we have to talk to the people who think about it.
Lisa Miller's book, Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife, is published by Harper's. And I want to thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you.